I was the only female member of the high school debate team. I said to all of my male debate partners, you ought to go to law school. It never occurred to me that I could do any of those things. I really, you know, admit what a blind spot I had. And then a couple of years later, I went off to Harvard College and I very quickly met women lawyers for the first time. And it was a big light bulb going off in my head. Oh, guess what? I can go to law school too.
Welcome back to Success Unscripted, the podcast where we peel back the curtain on real stories of success in the business world. I'm your host, Jonathan Israel, a financial advisor with Affinity Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services. To make my compliance officers happy, I'll mention that UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC. My office is located in Los Angeles, California, and I can be reached at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. I sat down with esteemed law professor and former president of the ACLU, Nadine Strossen. Nadine graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School and led the ACLU from 1991 to 2008 while teaching at New York Law School. She was named 100 Most Influential Lawyers by the National Law Journal and is the author of Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship, and Defending Pornography, Free Speech, Sex, and the Fight for Women's Rights. We talk about how she became president of the ACLU and ventured into a number of current issues, including government censorship, what she thinks of Elon Musk, and whether she believes Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. I should note, the world changes quickly, and this recording took place in the brief window between the assassination attempt on former President Trump and President Biden ending his campaign for re-election. In some ways, it makes this episode that much more interesting. And stay tuned after the interview for a short success story about someone you might know. Here's my conversation with Nadine Strossen. Hi, Nadine. I had the privilege of meeting you through our mutual involvement in a nonprofit FAIR, which stands for the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism. And it's a privilege to have you on and hear more about your story and get your perspective on current events. So thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, Jonathan. And thank you for supporting FAIR, which is a terrific organization. I've just become a member of its board of advisors and become even more engaged in it.
Yeah, really incredible people over there. I agree. I'm happy to be involved. You're well known for your time as head of the ACLU from 1991 to 2008. You also authored multiple books, including Defending Pornography, Free Speech, Sex, and the Fight for Women's Rights, and Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech. And this is a show about uncovering how people got to where they are. And it's a peek under the water at the proverbial iceberg, if you will. So let's begin with your time at the ACLU. I understand you were only the sixth president in its history to lead the organization.
Jonathan, thank you for the honor of participating in this important podcast series. Yes, although the ACLU was founded in 1920, in fact, its predecessor organization was founded even a couple years earlier. There was no term limit on the president who was elected for terms of 1 year at a time, but could be repeatedly reelected. It's a very, very demanding job for a very complex organization dealing with many issues. So the learning curve is very steep, and it's not surprising that the average tenure of an ACLU president is quite long, into the double digits. My predecessor had served for 15 years.
How are presidents chosen?
So the ACLU uses the term president to designate what other organizations call chair of the board. The terminology is slightly different from one organization to the next, but that is essentially what the ACLU president is. Accordingly, I was elected by the ACLU's National Board of Directors. I should point out, Jonathan, that fortunately, although the job of president is very substantial, there is also a chief executive officer whose title is executive director, who has that is a paid position. The presidency is not a paid position. So I did all of that as a volunteer on top of my full-time day job as a law professor at New York Law School. So for a couple of decades, I was leading a double life.
Oh, wow. So I guess I didn't realize that the president of the ACLU is not a paid professional.
Even many members of the organization don't realize that. So it's an organization whose capacity and influence, as is true for all civic organizations, including FAIR, the one that brought you and me together, all of them depend on a combination of dedicated, paid, but probably underpaid staff members and completely unpaid volunteers, right, which enable the organization to accomplish even more than it could through its staff members alone. And that's something that's so wonderful about the United States. My friends who are involved in human rights and other causes of common concern in other countries say that they're quite envious that their cultures, like their law societies and their faculties, don't have the same tradition that we have in this country of donating some of your time and your professional expertise pro bono, as we say, for the public good.
Yeah. So what are the duties of the president then?
The duties of the president are to, and the president is the top position in the organization. So that means the president is responsible for hiring all staff, including the executive director. That's probably the most important decision that the president makes, of course, in conjunction with other senior leadership. There's an executive committee and other leadership committees. But in presiding over the board of directors, it is the board that sets policy for the organization. And that means policy not only on substantive legal and civil liberties issues, which can be very difficult and very contentious. Not all civil libertarians agree on all issues. I say that with a smile because we tend to be a particularly disputatious group. And I can barely remember issues that came before the national board that were not decided based on very heated debates and split votes, because often there are situations where the issue presents more than one civil liberty concern. How do you strike an appropriate balance between privacy on the one hand and free speech on the other hand, between promoting equality of opportunity on the one hand and free speech on the other hand, non-establishment of religion on the one hand and free exercise of religion on the other hand? I could go on and on. These are very, very difficult issues in principle, and I would be embarrassed if we were unanimous. I think no thinking person and no thinking organization could have or should have unanimity on such challenging, complex issues.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So how are these complex issues then decided? Is it by vote, or does the president have more influence in the
Okay. Excellent question. Not to sound grandiose, but like the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, it's only one vote when it comes down to it. In fact, as president, since I presided over the board debate, I only voted when it was necessary to break a tie. Otherwise, I did not participate substantively in the debates. And the votes are based on thorough briefing on the issue. Usually we would have committees that would have studied the issues, made reports and recommendations. The staff would weigh in with its recommendations as well. And in addition to those interesting policy legal issues that are the most glamorous, probably, of course, as with every governing board, we have responsibilities about managerial issues, ranging from personnel issues to budgetary and finance issues and so forth.
That's really interesting. And this is a silly question, but is everyone at the ACLU an attorney by background?
First of all, I will tell you that there is no such thing as a silly question. If you have it, it is.
We'll see if I can't prove you wrong before we're done.
Many, many people have asked that. In fact, many people have told me they assume that you must be an attorney to be an ACLU member. And the answer is, not only do you not need to be a lawyer to be a member of the ACLU, you don't need to be a lawyer to be an officer or leader of the ACLU. Our longtime executive directors with outstanding records of accomplishment have not been lawyers. The current one happens to have a law degree, although he never practiced law. But his predecessor, who was in place for 30 years, was a mathematician. And his predecessor, who was also in place for a substantial amount of time, was a journalist. We have had minister, social worker. Founding executive director, Roger Baldwin, was a respected social worker. So, and in fact, Jonathan, there are many lawyers who are very ignorant about civil liberties or even constitutional law, which is not, and constitutional law is somewhat required in law school. But when I say somewhat, many law schools now are not requiring any study at all of the First Amendment, including freedom of speech and freedom of religion, freedom of the press, not at all required. It's an optional course. So you can graduate from law school, you can pass the bar without having studied major components of civil liberties law. Conversely, there are many people who have never gone to law school who pursue other fields from history to political science to philosophy who are deeply knowledgeable about civil liberties and constitutional law.
That's wild to me that it's not required. How do you feel about that?
That is a fairly recent innovation, and I am sad. On the one hand, as a civil libertarian, you will not be surprised that I tend to favor giving individual adults, including law students, self-determination in choosing what courses are they deem to be important, the most important for their future careers. On the other hand, I'm very disappointed that relatively few of them seem to be choosing First Amendment free speech law as an elective. And I think that is part of the current pattern that has been very well documented, that increasing numbers of students at both the undergraduate and graduate level, including law school, tend to have disrespect for or even hostility toward free speech. Students tend overwhelmingly toward the left end of the political spectrum. And for better or worse, I would say for worse, free speech has come to be associated with the right end of the political spectrum. And believe you me, I think that everybody all across the political spectrum not only should have freedom of speech, but should robustly defend it for everybody else. And even assuming for the sake of argument that more conservatives were taking advantage of it than liberals, which is a hypothetical that is completely out of sync with reality, but even assuming that were true, that would not at all undermine the importance of the principle that regardless of what you believe, you have a First Amendment free speech right to express your beliefs. And other people have a First Amendment free speech right to ignore you, to challenge you, to question you, to debate you, and so forth.
You were a professor at New York Law School, and then the position opens up to be president of the ACLU. So I'm curious, were multiple people trying to get this job, and why you at the end were chosen?
Well, so as I already indicated, Jonathan, it was a job that I would have to assume on top of my substantial responsibilities as a full-time law professor with a heavy teaching load at New York Law School and heavy scholarship responsibilities, which I was very much enjoying. I've now taken emeritus status so that I can become a full-time advocate on free speech and associated issues. But till the end, and I taught full-time for more than 30 years, I really loved every minute of teaching and being a professor. And so when I found out that my predecessor as ACLU president was stepping down and various leaders of the board of directors encouraged me to run for the contested position, because of course it's an opportunity that comes along so infrequently, it's a rare opportunity that many people were eager to pursue. My initial decision was that I didn't want to do it. I was fairly a newly tenured and thriving, but at the beginning of my academic career. And I knew that the responsibilities of being ACLU president would definitely greatly cut back on the time I would have available for scholarship in particular. I'd still go ahead and teach my classes, and that I would have to lead this double life of running an organization to a large extent, plus having another full-time job. So I initially decided that I wouldn't pursue the opportunity. And to make a long story short, after a lot of deliberation and a lot of consultation with people I deeply respected, including a friend who is a mental health professional, and she gave me her professional judgment. She said, you know, I was not very good at taking criticism. That's an understatement, Jonathan. I was very bad at taking unfair criticism. Now, of course, most of us think that all criticism we get is unfair. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that with a smile. But and you can imagine when you're advocating what are always controversial and difficult issues, such as civil liberties issues, you are subject to a lot of unfair criticism. I'm sure some of it is fair. And I took that very, very hard. And she said to me, you have no obligation to pursue this position. And if you do take it, I mean, if you pursue it and you are elected, you have to change your personality. You cannot survive in that role if you are so undermined by unfair criticism, because that's part of the job. And she said, yeah, I can help you. And there are other skills that one can build to learn to become resilient and rise above unfair criticism. But if that doesn't work, and if you're unhappy, then the second lesson I'm going to tell you, Nadine, is that you should step down. It's not a lifetime obligation. And if it's making you unhappy, you don't have to stay with it. So with that and other encouraging advice in mind, Jonathan, I decided fairly late in the game that I would throw my hat in the ring. By that time, far more contestants had entered than I think otherwise would have, because there were people who had supported me on the board had shifted their support to other candidates because they thought I wasn't running and they felt that they were bound to the other candidates. So I was starting a little bit further behind than I would have otherwise. But I don't regret that. It was very, very hard fought, hard campaigned process of multiple months during which I had. So the ACLU National Board is very large. We have more than 80 members. Large, and the reason that it's large is that we structured it to make sure that every state in the United States would have a representative on the ACLU National Board to accommodate for regional differences, and also a certain number of so-called at-large positions to represent national constituencies. So that's why it was very large and complicated and diverse group. And yet it was small enough and the time for the campaign was long enough that I had to have and wanted to have and did have protracted conversations and discussions with every single elector, if you will, every single member of the national board. So the electoral process, the campaign process, was itself extremely educational for me and for the members of the board of directors. And when I was elected, I really was able to hit the ground running in a way that I wouldn't have if there had not been such an intense campaign period. I had learned so much about the organization and about the other board leaders that I didn't know before.
What do you think was the deciding factor in your victory?
I hope that this doesn't sound immodest, because I certainly am aware of what my less strong points are. But my strongest point ties back to what I'm doing now, which is I really enjoy public speaking, and I've been told that I am a persuasive communicator with many different constituencies. At that time in the organization's history, it was seen as particularly important that we be able to effectively and sympathetically convey a pro-civil liberties message to a public that was quite hostile. I should tell you, just to anchor this in time, and this will be ancient history for so many of your audience members, but this election took place just a couple years after the 1988 presidential election, in which George H.W. Bush was running against Michael Dukakis, who had been governor of Massachusetts. Michael Dukakis proudly described himself in the Iowa caucuses, which were then the first Democratic contest in the electoral campaign, described himself as a card-carrying member of the ACLU. And he meant that as something positive. But Bush immediately and skillfully turned that against him as something unpatriotic and using the same kind of innuendo that had been used against communists during the McCarthy era, right? A card-carrying member of the Communist Party.
Right.
And at that time, the ACLU was seen as extremely left. So it was, you know, equated in many people's minds with communism, and not only on the part of the Republican Party. When Clinton comes along in the next election cycle, he really distanced himself from the left part of the Democratic Party, moved way toward the center. I can't remember the term that he used for that, and definitely explicitly distanced himself from civil liberties in the ACLU. His chief of staff, I think that was the position that Rahm Emanuel, who held a lot of leadership positions in that administration, was being criticized by the ACLU for one of many, many positions that Clinton took that were deeply inconsistent with civil liberties, including the now notorious crime bill that Biden was also supporting in his capacity as a senator and had to walk back because the political tides have changed again. But at that time, to be speaking against a massive crime bill that drastically increased penalties, drastically increased incarceration, was demonstrably racially discriminatory in its impact and enforcement. But we didn't even have the Congressional Black Caucus on our side because everybody was so concerned with the reported escalation or perceived escalation in crime. I'm just using that as one of many examples where today issues where I would be considered conservative by the progressives who want to defund the police and end prisons altogether. But in those days, it was considered radical to even want to reduce mass incarceration. So that was the reason why my major role, and I really relished it, was making a case for civil liberties among other sectors of the population, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. And when I was elected, the New York Times had one of those person in the news profiles about me. And under my photograph, the poll quote that they had came from the speech, the campaign speech I made to the board of directors right before the vote. And my quote was, "I want to emphasize the American in American Civil Liberties Union."
Yeah, wow. That's such an incredible history. It's funny how things change over time. You know,
and we keep going through cycles. Yeah,
the cycles continue. So I wanted to ask you if, because before you were a professor, you were a practicing attorney for a period of time, graduated from Harvard Law School magna cum laude. Did you always know from a very young age that you wanted to be an attorney or that you wanted to work in human rights?
The latter, yes. The former, no. And this is a story that I always tell on myself, Jonathan. When I was growing up, I didn't know any attorneys at all, and I had never heard of any female attorneys. I'm not one of these pioneering people, and I know they exist, who don't need role models, who just have it in their own mind that this is what I want to do, and I'm going to do it. And I don't care if nobody else like me has done it before. I was not like that. And I was completely committed to human rights in my own way. I didn't know the terminology, but advocating for them from a very young age, grade school and middle school, when controversies came up involving teachers and other students and my own free speech rights and the rights of students to access library books and so forth. And then when my mother, I grew up in Minnesota, but my mother was a transplanted New Yorker, very unhappily transplanted. So she subscribed to the New York Times, which was quite unusual in Minnesota. And I remember reading a New York Times article about how Harvard Law School was opening the very first legal aid bureau at a law school. And the idea was that law students would gain clinical, i.e. practical, hands-on training as part of their law school education by providing legal services to poor people who couldn't. I mean, they would do it under the supervision of an actual licensed attorney. So it was a double win for people who otherwise would not get legal services and for students who otherwise would not have hands-on legal training. And I thought that was just a brilliant idea. I was so excited by it. At that point, I was in high school and I was a member of our high school state championship debate team. They say that, three-time Minnesota state champion. And I loved arguing and research. And one of the years we actually had a law topic. So I used to take the public bus in Minneapolis down to the University of Minnesota Law School and Library, do legal research. And I just loved it. And I was the only female member of the high school debate team. I said to all of my male debate partners, you ought to go to law school and you ought to go to Harvard Law School and you ought to join the Legal Aid Bureau. And honestly, Martha, it never occurred to me that I could do any of those things. I really, you know, admit what a blind spot I had. And then a couple of years later, I went off to Harvard College and immediately became involved in the reproductive rights movement and the second wave of the women's movement. And through that, I very quickly met women lawyers for the first time. And it was a big light bulb going off in my head. Oh, guess what? I can go to law school too. So I went to law school, to Harvard Law School, and I joined the Legal Aid Bureau.
Amazing.
But I smile because, you know, I wish, I know that you often ask people, what advice would you give your 20-year-old self? Well, I guess I would have given it to my 17 or 18-year-old self. Just because there's no forerunner, just because nobody else that, to your knowledge, has done something, shouldn't be seen as a barrier. There has to be a first for everything. And then, of course, I learned that there were amazing women who centuries ago became lawyers, even though everybody told them they couldn't, in addition to having no role models. So I wish I had been a little bit bolder, but it turned out okay.
Looking back at your time at the ACLU, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of the path-breaking leadership the ACLU took in defending freedom of speech, including for young people, on the then new and very greatly feared new communications medium, the internet. I have to point this out to my students who have just taken it for granted. What a different world we could have lived in if the ACLU had not prevailed in what became the Supreme Court's first case, landmark decision, about freedom of speech in cyberspace called Reno versus ACLU. Reno refers to Janet Reno, who was Bill Clinton's attorney general. Younger people are shocked to learn that when the internet first received the attention of the public and politicians and the press in the late 80s and early 90s, it was greeted with enormous anxiety, fear, panic isn't too strong of a word. And leading publications, print publications, were printing articles about how this would endanger children and subject them to pedophiles, how, you know, bomb-making instructions would be disseminated to terrorists. It would basically be the end of civilization. And Congress responded as lawmakers have responded to every new communications medium throughout history. It passed by overwhelming bipartisan majorities a very strong censorship law. It was called the Communications Decency Act, signed into law and defended through the federal courts by the Clinton administration. You could count on the fingers of one hand the members of Congress who voted against it. And we were very, very apprehensive going into the Supreme Court argument, what these nine relatively, I mean, then I thought they were relatively elderly, now I would say mature justices of a certain age who were not familiar with the internet at all. Our lawyers had to give them a demonstration in chambers of how it operated. But to their great credit, they insisted that the same tried and true First Amendment principles that apply to print media, had to apply to the internet. Otherwise, the internet would not live up to its promise to be the most mass participatory form of communications media in history. If the Clinton administration and members of Congress and the public and press had had their way, the internet would have been reduced to the same second status under the First Amendment, second class status, that broadcast media have. And again, many people are shocked to learn you still can't use four-letter words, even if they're in Supreme Court opinions. They get bleeped on broadcast TV. We had a whole list of clients, including the major bookstore organization, major publishing organization, the major newspaper organization, library association, women's rights organizations, human rights organizations, LGBTQ rights organizations, the ACLU itself. All of our expression would have been subject to censorship as so-called indecent or patently offensive. And I played a very active role in that litigation. So I'm very proud of that.
When you stepped down from the ACLU, actually you had three Supreme Court justices participated in your farewell tribute. And it was not just on one side. You had Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You also had Antonin Scalia there and David Souter, as I recall.
Yes. And these they've all retired, sadly, two have died. David Souter, thankfully, is still alive, but not on the Supreme Court. And Souter was appointed as a conservative Republican. He became to be seen as more of a centrist, moderate, maybe even liberal member of the court in the middle, definitely. And Scalia was then the leading, most outspoken conservative voice on the court, and Ginsburg its most outspoken leading liberal. And just as Ginsburg and Scalia themselves famously were very close friends, despite their ideological differences, I had the privilege of being very close friends independently with both of them, as well as with Justice Souter. And that kind of collegiality and the opportunity to develop friendships with and respect for people with whom you disagree is something I very much prize. I should say, Jonathan, I'm fond of saying that I became very good friends with Nino, as he asked me to call him, Scalia, not despite our disagreements, strong disagreements on many issues, although no two people can disagree on everything. So we also had strong agreements on some important issues, but we became good friends because of those disagreements, which prompted various organizations around the country and in various other countries as well to invite us to debate each other at conferences and bar association conventions. And in that process, we had the opportunity to have conversations and to develop a friendly relationship. I find it sad that these kinds of cross-partisan relationships are apparently becoming much more difficult to pursue on the court and in Congress and other agencies of government.
Do you think the culture of free speech is eroding in the United States?
Yes, I do. And sadly, that is confirmed not only by enormous anecdotal experience that I have as somebody who's constantly on the campus lecture circuit and speaking in other forums, but there are constant public opinion surveys that are done by Pew and Gallup and by College Pulse and many, many other organizations that consistently show not only a general lack of respect for free speech, that has always been with us, Jonathan. I can say that polls have always shown that most people, as I like to summarize it, believe in freedom of speech for me, but not for thee. So freedom of speech for all ideas, except the ideas that they hate and that they think are dangerous. And that's always been true. But what has changed in the past couple of decades is that erosion has now spread to institutions in our society and culture that traditionally have been particularly strong defenders, bastions of free speech, starting with academia, continuing on to journalism, media, publishing, libraries, institutions that in the past you could count on to staunchly defend free speech are now proudly questioning it and even rejecting it.
A lot of things that have happened in the recent past that have opened my eyes, and I'm starting to wonder myself if the culture in the United States is kind of moving away from free speech, which would be a very sad thing. And I can't help but think about and ask you what your opinion is of a somewhat maybe controversial figure in certain circles, Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first of all, I couldn't agree with you more that lacking a free speech culture and instead having a cancel culture, one that is seeking to shame and punish and suppress controversial ideas, that is a critical component of whether we do or don't have free speech. We have, as I indicated, very speech protective law in this country, even with all of the fragmentation of the current Supreme Court on many issues, including some fragmentation on free speech issues. The court, by and large, continues to very strongly, consistently protect speech that public opinion polls show that members of the public think should not be protected. So-called hate speech, so-called extremist speech, so-called pornography, and so forth. So having speech protective law is necessary, but not sufficient for people to meaningfully enjoy and exercise free speech. FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, just came out with a new survey that it does every year, assessing the climate of free speech on campus. It does it together with College Pulse, and its results were sadly not shocking, but distressing. They're consistent with similar results from other organizations in past years, that students and faculty members on campuses where you would expect robust free speech to be especially thriving, that they are reporting that they cannot have a frank and candid conversation on their campus about the most important topics that are matters of urgent public policy debate, about abortion, about immigration, about police practices, anything to do with race, anything to do with gender. And when you ask why that is, the answer is not that they're afraid that they're going to be arrested by the police, not that they're afraid that they're going to be punished by university officials or get a bad grade from their professor. The answer is, and faculty members as well as students say that they're afraid of other students. They're afraid of peer pressure, of viral social media attacks, of campaigns to socially isolate them or to deny them more tangible benefits. And the problem with a culture that is not receptive to free speech is that the solution is not as clear-cut as an illegal, as an unconstitutional law. I was just reading about, because we have so many censorial laws that are being enacted and proposed in states all over the country, restricting what can be taught in public schools, what books can be included in school and public libraries, what can be in the curriculum and not in the curriculum. Many people have heard of, for example, Florida's Stop Woke Act, precisely because those laws are so deeply inconsistent with First Amendment values. We've been able to strike them down in the courts. The ACLU, FIRE, and others have succeeded in doing that. But there is no legal solution to a cultural problem. The culture has to change within itself. And when you're talking about a student culture, it's not something that I, of a very different generation, can do anything about. I work with students all the time. I try to provide the maximum support and inspiration and mentorship that I can. But ultimately, it requires courageous students who are willing to stand up and speak up and, you know, buck the tide, defend free speech principles on their campuses.
Yeah, I don't know what we're doing wrong on college campuses, but I know Jonathan Haidt, who you know, has written about this, and he wrote that book, The Coddling of the American Mind, which was a really fantastic book. And it, I think it opened up, you know, a lot of people, they save a lot of money. And we work in the financial planning business. And so, you know, we help people achieve their goals. Some of them is to send their kids to college. And, you know, so this is something they do. They send their kids off to college. They assume they're getting, you know, a good education. And then that book really revealed a lot of things that are going on in college campuses that I think to me are really in opposition to the culture of free speech.
One of the things that was revealed in that book, which I have to say was co-authored, I really admire and respect John Hyde. I have the privilege of working with him in Heterodox Academy, which he co-founded, another great organization along with FAIR and FIRE. But he co-authored that with FIRE's CEO, Greg Lukianoff. And their hypothesis when they started writing the book was that, I won't say it's their hypothesis, but one of the hypotheses that they examined that other people had advanced, critics of universities, was that, and I think the criticism was coming from the right, that these woke, progressive, left-leaning professors are indoctrinating these innocent students when they come to campus. And what John and Greg's research revealed was, no, the students were coming into college already having those attitudes that they would be harmed by words that they disagreed with, that speech is violence, and that they had to be protected from ideas that they disagreed with and speakers that they disagreed with. And I've been, over the summer, I have the opportunity to work with middle and high school teachers from all over the country. Talk about courage. I mean, these people are facing such enormous pressures from both ends of the political spectrum, with enormous pressures from state legislatures and governors and school boards and parents. And they're certainly not doing it for the money. These people are so committed. And those of us who depend on creating a free speech culture really are indebted to them, Jonathan, because what they can do to help nurture a culture of free speech, a knowledge of free speech, a respect for free speech among their young students, who would then bring those pro-free speech attitudes to campus. I mean, that to me really is the potential salvation for the future. Elon Musk made wonderful pronouncements when he announced that he was acquiring what was then Twitter, that he would be very strongly speech protective. But in practice, he quite quickly abandoned his pro-free speech policies. And, you know, I haven't followed every single detail, but my general observation is that all of them fall short. I remember his predecessor, Jack Dorsey, said very proudly at one point, Twitter is the free speech wing of the free speech party. How quickly he capitulated under great pressure from Congress. So Musk certainly has done some things that are promotive of free speech. I haven't followed every single detail of his record, but let me mention something positive since I said that he has not been perfect by a long stretch, but he immediately upon acquiring Twitter, he released the so-called Twitter files that were a trove of email communications between Twitter staff members and government officials, mostly in the Biden administration, although some in the Trump administration, as I understand it, in which government officials, this leads to another couple of Supreme Court cases that were recently decided, government officials put a lot of pressure on Twitter to remove certain content that the officials believed to be disinformation or so-called malinformation, which is true information that could be misleading. And that raises the very important First Amendment issue, which is, even if the social media companies have their own First Amendment rights to make their own editorial decisions about what speech they will host and what they will not host. And as I said earlier, I think that is their First Amendment right. I don't think government regulation should deprive them of their editorial discretion as the Florida and Texas laws did. But it's one thing for them to voluntarily decide to take down some expression or some speakers. It's another thing for them to do it because the government is pressuring them to do it. through veiled or sometimes not so veiled threats that you better do this or we're going to subject you to more government regulation. We're going to bring an antitrust investigation against you. We're going to repeal your immunity under famous Section 230 and so forth. And so I really do think that Musk performed a very important public service by disclosing those communications. Presumably, they've gone on with the other social media companies as well, and they have not disclosed the comparable communications.
Let me ask you about another topic before we wrap up. We just witnessed an assassination attempt on President Trump. I'm curious what your reaction is to that.
I assume the universal reaction is horror and shock. Although that said, I'm old enough that I vividly remember the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy, sadly. So the United States has a history, and of course the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan. The United States has a sad and long history. I also saw another pattern which accompanies every violent event, upsetting event in U.S. history in my experience, and that is an immediate impulse to blame free speech. Immediately, there are charges that it's rhetoric that has led to this, and violent and vehement divisive rhetoric that has led to this. And on the other side of it, we immediately see situations where people are making very polemical, extreme statements, such as, including on social media, too bad they missed. I hope next time they get him, which raises questions of, is that protected speech or not protected speech? And we saw very similar incidents in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, that maybe it was too much free speech on the internet that had led to this terrible attack. And even on college campuses had professors who made pretty controversial statements that were celebrating the terrorists, not dissimilar to what we saw after the Hamas attack on Gaza last October. And we come face to face with, ugly as that rhetoric is, you know, both before the attack and after the attack. And much as we wish that people would exercise self-restraint not to express themselves that way, they have a free speech right to do it.
Right.
You know, our remedy is not to punish them, but to ignore them, to not be persuaded by them.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's completely fair for Biden and Trump and others to urge people to tone down the rhetoric. That itself is an exercise of free speech. But I think the Supreme Court has recognized that there have been Supreme Court cases very strikingly on point that say in the political arena, vituperative, often abusive speech and hyperbole is just natural. When people feel strongly and impassioned, they're going to say extreme things. So back in 1969, the Supreme Court had a case. This was during the Vietnam era, but the facts could be strikingly similar to factual situations today. A young black man, 18 years old, Robert Watts, was participating in an anti-war, anti-police brutality demonstration in Washington, D.C., a demonstration against police abuse of black men. And he was afraid that he was going to be drafted. He had the military draft on. And he said, if they ever draft me, the first person I'm going to get in my sights is LBJ, referring to Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president of the United States. He was convicted of threatening the president of the United States, a pretty serious crime. And that crime was upheld on appeal, but the U.S. Supreme Court overturned it. It said it's political hyperbole, you know, in the heat of expressing yourself on issues that you feel strongly about. Expression cannot be nicely channeled into purely dulcet expression.
Oh, yeah. No, I get that. And yeah, the rhetoric, I mean, I guess it's a bit subjective if the rhetoric is too hot or not. There are people, without trying to take a side here. There are people who are saying that, no, you know, Donald Trump is a real threat to democracy and freedom. And so
I hear people on the Trump side of the aisle saying the same thing about Biden. They say he's a threat to democracy.
Right. Right. That's true.
And that's their free speech right to say that.
Right. And it's their right to say that. Do you view either as a threat to democracy?
I think that is hyperbolic rhetoric. I suppose democracy is always very fragile, way free speech is very fragile, Jonathan, but I'm very confident that we can endure thanks to a constitutional system that has proven itself to be amazingly sound, the most long-lasting, enduring constitution in the history of humanity. For all of its flaws and imperfections, from the beginning, it included the ability to amend it. And the amendments have improved it, have brought us closer to a system that can promote liberty and justice for all. I say that not at all to suggest that we've won, the fight is over, but for exactly the opposite reason. We've made so much progress using our democratic tools of free speech and Republican self-government that we should be encouraged to keep on with the good fight. But as Thomas Jefferson reportedly said, somebody said, and if not Thomas Jefferson, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. It's an ongoing struggle every single minute of our history. And as you indicated, every single one of us, as one of those who wield the sovereign power in this country, belongs to we the people, and it's up to us to preserve democracy. I continue to have confidence in the American people.
I have to ask you, this is a really big topic right now in regards to civil liberties, and this conversation about democracy is the issue of what many people, including the Wall Street Journal editorial board, have described as lawfare against President Trump. And what I guess what that means is that means the use of the legal system to go after or delegitimize their opponents in cases maybe that normally wouldn't have been brought or maybe stretched a bit. The other side is claiming that, you know, look, this is just black and white. No one is above the law, including former President Trump. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, if you have concerns or an opinion on it.
I think, again, as with all of the issues that we're talking about, the charges can be made and have been made by both sides against the other side, right? So Donald Trump's mantra on the second last time he ran for president was lock her up, right? Suggesting a criminal response to some of Hillary Clinton's actions. And I think that no one is above the law. That is really an important principle, including the President of the United States. But it's also true that our laws give an enormous amount of discretion to those who enforce them, necessarily because there are so many laws and they're so detailed, and prosecutors have so much power and so many resources that they could prosecute just about, I'd strike the just about, I was going to say just about everybody. Harvey Silverglade, who's a civil liberties and criminal defense lawyer in Boston, who was one of the chief co-founders of FIRE, quite a few years ago, wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day. And he said that, you know, we have so many laws on the books that if any prosecutor wants to go after anybody, they can prosecute them for at least three felonies. And so the question is this a wise use of resources? So I'm not even reaching the issue of on the fact, did it satisfy whatever the legal standard was? I quite frankly haven't had time to follow that in detail. I'm up to my neck just in First Amendment issues. But just on the question of whether this is a wise use of prosecutorial resources, I remember something that Barack Obama did that I was very, when he, shortly after he was elected president, I was quite disappointed then as ACLU president, but I understood his reason for doing it. And that was a decision not to prosecute George W. Bush for war crimes, even though there was a lot of evidence that war crimes had been committed in the prosecution of the war on terror, including torture. And Obama made a statement not saying that no crimes had been committed, but that the most constructive action was to use our democratic process to change the policies and move constructively toward the future, not the past. So I think that what I'm telling you is that this is consistent with my generally non-punitive, that we have too much of a punitive attitude. We are generally overusing our criminal justice system in ways that are counterproductive in general. And I would say even beyond Donald Trump, I'm agnostic on this. I think I'm very open to persuasion that the prosecutions are not justified because of all the general factors that I've laid out. But I certainly would say the same thing about so many ordinary people who are being locked up for infractions that in other countries would warrant probation or some kind of restorative justice or rehabilitative approach. And in the political sphere, I think the answer is a political remedy. You know, you think what he's done is wrong, then vote against him or don't nominate him. But let's not turn the criminal justice system into an arm of the what should be partisan political function of our system.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I remember that Lock Her Up. That was rather distasteful, I think. And I think to my recollection, I don't think he actually acted once he became president
right.
on that. I think so.
I think that's correct.
Which I'm glad. Yeah, which I'm glad, because that should not be a weapon.
But you know what?
Each side gets to do when to the other when, you know, when they eventually wield the power.
And I think the chances that there will be tit for tat are increased, right? Once it's done by one, it's more likely it'll be done by the other.
Yeah, I'm curious because, you know, Michael Schellenberger, who we both know through FAIR, he had called for, and I don't know how you feel about his work, but he's done some really interesting work here.
And I admire his work a lot.
He's called for a bipartisan blue ribbon commission to reform America's intelligence community for some of the censorship efforts. And he thinks that counterterrorism techniques were repurposed to prevent Donald Trump from taking office again, which I know you probably have a lot of background in your experience with the ACLU, because I remember that's when the Patriot Act came up.
Michael's work that I'm familiar with, including his work on free speech, and including on the Twitter file, I've found very admirable and impressive. And I have been very distressed at how intelligence community abuses, which traditionally throughout my adult lifetime were critiqued by the left with the Church Commission and then the Patriot Act, as you said, suddenly the left has become supportive of an expansive expansion of intelligence, surveillance, censorship, and privacy invading powers in the name of not only international terrorism, but domestic security. And I wish, again, there's so much of a tendency to look at who is the immediate beneficiary or target of particular strategy, and what is the partisan lineup, without thinking of the longer term consequences of allowing these tools to be deployed and recognizing that they can be and have been deployed against people and ideas on exactly the opposite partisan valence.
Yeah. Well, I could talk to you for hours. I looked down. The time just flew by. So I really, really appreciate this. Just to finish up, I mean, is there anything you'd like to promote? What are you doing right now?
I am writing a book proposal for my newest book. My second newest book was part of an Oxford University Press trade named series called What Everyone Needs to Know. And the one that I published in 2023 was Free Speech, What Everyone Needs to Know. Based on our conversation, Jonathan, you'll recognize that I see that a big cause of the lack of free speech culture, the eroding free speech culture, is ignorance about free speech. And so as part and parcel of advocating for free speech, I want people to know about it. I had a great deal of fun writing that book, and now I'm writing a book proposal for something similar, which also does not yet exist in the series, about academic freedoms and free speech on campus, what everyone needs to know.
How can people get in touch with you? Are you on social media?
I am not on social media. I made that decision many years ago. I do not regret it. But, okay, boomer, I actually answer email, as you know. So people should feel free to email me. My email address is very easily findable deliberately. If they Google me, they'll come across my New York Law School faculty page, and it's got the address prominently on it.
Wonderful. Thank you again for your time. It's been incredible to talk to you. Good luck with the book and everything you do in the future. Appreciate it.
You too, Jonathan. Thank you so much for hosting me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode with Nadine Strossen. Now, here's a short success story about someone you might know. Success comes from standing out, not fitting in. Those words might have been said by Don Draper in Mad Men, but on the real Madison Avenue of the 1960s, there was one that stood out above the rest, and she wasn't a man. As the first woman to own and run a national advertising agency and the first female chief executive of a company listed on the New York Stock Exchange, Mary is remembered for creating some of the world's most memorable ad campaigns. Born in Youngstown, Ohio, on May 25, 1928, she was the only child of Waldemar and Violet. Her father was a furniture salesman, and to help her overcome her shyness, her mother enrolled her in acting, dancing, and music classes. She first performed at the Youngstown Playhouse when she was 5, and at 17 she began studying at the Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh. She relocated to New York to study theater and drama and found a job in advertising. Her career took off in 1964 when she joined the ad agency of Jack Tinker & Partners, where she developed the campaign for Braniff International Airways with the tagline, "The End of the Plain Plane," which was credited with reinvigorating the struggling airline. After being denied a promotion in 1966, she left to create her own agency with two other executives. They set up shop in a hotel suite, signed Braniff as their first client, and soon won Benson & Hedges, Burma Toiletries, and Utica Club Beer. Within months, she was a national celebrity. Some highlights from her career include Trust the Midas Touch. At Ford, quality is job one. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Leading Alka-Seltzer sales to double as consumers got into the habit of taking two tablets instead of one. But perhaps the most enduring legacy of her agency, Wells Rich Green, was done for the New York Department of Commerce, who wanted to reinvigorate tourism in the 1970s. The I Love New York campaign. Yes, that one, with the red heart and typewriter font. It's no wonder she became the industry's highest paid executive, eventually selling her agency for the equivalent of $385 million today. And that's the true story of the woman who was described as the most powerful and successful woman ever to work in advertising, Mary Wells Lawrence, who passed away in the year of this recording, 2024. And that's the way she did it. Thank you again for listening. And a special thank you to producer Jake, content manager Angeline, and everyone else who made this podcast possible. If you enjoyed this episode of Success Unscripted, please like and share. If you have feedback, or if you or someone you know would be a good guest for our show, please reach out to us at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.